You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Kia ora Motat and kia ora Alan.
Hey.
What's up?
Well, it's getting near the end of the year, I guess, which is good.
Good and a little bit scary, but...
Yeah, I know.
It's mostly good.
God.
2020, the end of 2020 can't come soon enough. Uh-huh. Anyway, our first story. Water has been spotted doing some weird things. Can you tell us what the hell's going
on
with that?
Well, water does lots of weird things anyway. We kind of take it for granted because it is ubiquitous. It's all around us. And... we just sort of think, yeah, it's just water. But water actually is really weird. So a few weird things about water. Number one, ice floats on water. The solid form floats on the liquid form. And that's really bizarre because normally solids are meant to be more dense than liquids. And this isn't the case in water. So the solid form of water is less dense. And water's got its maximum density at 4 degrees Celsius, and then the density decreases. And this is why your pipes burst in winter.
Right, so that's why ice expands.
Right, water expands when it freezes, and so therefore, yeah. So that's weird. There's not many other substances on planet Earth that do that. The melting point of water decreases as you increase the pressure. That's weird as well. That's another weird thing about water. Water is... It boils at 100 degrees, and we all know that, but that's actually weird. It shouldn't. This is all due to hydrogen bonding and stuff like that. But, and so people have sort of been thinking, well, you know, why is water so weird? So there's a bunch of folks, this is a real, truly multinational bunch of folks who have been looking at super cooled water. Now, another one of the weird things about water is that you can super cool it. So we normally think of water as turning to ice at 0 degrees, at atmospheric pressure, of course. But you can actually take water down to well into the negatives before it freezes, provided it's absolutely pure and that you've got it in the right sort of container that doesn't have any sort of rough edges or anything on it. And it's been thought that supercooled water is weird, and it is, and it's thought that it exists in two forms, a high density form and a low density form. And the problem is that the experiment to be able to show that this is the case hasn't been able to be done until now. So, as I say, a bunch of multinationals, so in Europe and Asia and the States, have all got together and they've been studying ice at around about minus 70 odd degrees, okay? So this is special high pressure ice. They call it amorphous ice, which means it doesn't have any sort of internal structure. They make this stuff, and then this is at around about sort of 3,000 times atmospheric pressure, and then they shoot an infrared laser at it, and they give it a femtosecond pulse.
What's a femtosecond? Wow.
Femtosecond, there we go. I'm hoping you're asking that. That's 10 to the minus 15 seconds.
Right.
Okay, ridiculously
short.
Not many seconds. Not many seconds at all. And what this does is that this melts the ice pretty much instantaneously. And then what they can do is watch what happens to that liquid water, because now that liquid water is around about minus 70 degrees and it's under very, very, very high pressure. And they can probe this with a thing called an X-ray laser. So this is just like your normal bog standard sort of handheld lasers. Instead of sort of firing out red or green light, it actually fires out X-rays, which you don't want to look at, obviously. But you can determine what's happening through this X-ray laser. And so they've done this experiment, they've hit it with the infrared laser, they've probed it with the X-ray laser, and what they've found is, as they thought, that water seems to exist as two forms, the supercooled water. It's a very, very high density form, and then within nanoseconds, which is 10 to the minus 9 seconds, it reverts to the low density form, and then it freezes back into ice again. So that's the problem. With the experiment was trying to beat the freeze, as it were, mm-hmm. Get this liquid at these very, very low temperatures and very, very high pressures, and be able to actually probe what is going on in that liquid. And so that's what they found. And that's kind of interesting because it then implies that water can exist perhaps in two different liquid forms. And if it can do that, then there's some point at which one form turns into the other, and that's a thing called a critical point. Mm-hmm. And if this is the case, then people are thinking, okay, so the water that we know in our everyday lives might then be what is called a supercritical fluid.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Well, you might have heard of supercritical carbon dioxide, maybe.
I have not.
Supercritical CO2. No. Okay. So if you don't like caffeine in your coffee, you would hit it with this thing called supercritical CO2, which is carbon dioxide, gaseous carbon dioxide, under tremendous, well, not tremendous, but high pressure and high temperature. And then it takes on properties of being both a gas and a liquid. Supercritical is what we call it. So it's weird. And so people are thinking that water might itself be a supercritical fluid, and it might have these weird properties. And in fact, there might be pockets of water that are high density, pockets of water that are low density, and all this sort of stuff going on under our noses. And people have written treatises on water, you know, the books and books and books and volumes and volumes, and it's such a normal everyday thing, and we think we know everything about it, but by God, we don't.
It is one of those things that we just take for granted completely.
Oh, yes, indeed. But there's still a lot to be learned about water. So, it's kind of cool.
All right, well, this next story I've got here, rats with poisonous fur. Yes, please. how cute.
So adorable. The African crested rat. Now, I reckon rats get a bad name, really.
Rats are great.
We get a lot of rats out to Tauranga Way. Sadly, the cats sort of do for them, unfortunately. But occasionally, a couple live, and they're really cute, actually, I reckon. But, you know, I think they're unfairly maligned. But the African crested rat is not necessarily one that you would want to, let's say, lick. Because it is in fact poisonous, but which isn't to say that it's not cute. So apparently they're about the size of rabbits and they purr.
Ooh,
now how cool is that? That's and if you look up the story and look at the photos of them, they really are quite cute. So these were discovered apparently in 1867, by science anyway, and they've sort of been difficult to come across ever since then. And certainly in terms of studying, they're not the easiest things to study, very difficult to find and study. So it was kind of thought that, yeah, they are poisonous, but sort of they didn't know how they were poisonous, why they were poisonous, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so what was done is in 2011, they did a study of one rat, and they surmised that this rat was actually eating the bark, or at least licking or chewing the bark of a thing called the poison arrow tree, which it's all there in the name, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and then basically applying the poison part of the bark to itself, to its sides. So it would sort of mix it with saliva and lick its sides, thereby putting poison on its flanks and rendering itself hopefully sort of harmful to particular predators. So now there's a new study that's just been done by some Americans, and what they managed to do was to get 25 of these cute little critters.
Lucky.
I know. And then they put them under cameras and everything, and so they monitored their movements and everything for quite some time. I think they had about 1,000 hours of footage, and you can imagine going through 1,000 hours of video footage wouldn't be...
Lucky.
Yeah. and yes, that's what they found, that they were in fact getting these poison arrow trees. They were chewing the bark, mixing it with their saliva, and then licking themselves and putting this poison on their flanks.
Does that poison pose a risk to them?
No, that's the really interesting thing, is that they're seemingly unaffected by this. They can chew away on this stuff as long as they want. Nothing happens. Now, they think that that's because of the fact that they've got this weird four-chambered stomach. I think cows have got four stomachs. Similar sort of things, I think. But lots and lots and lots of gut microbes in there that apparently very possibly chew up all of these nasties before they can do any damage. So, so it's poisonous, but it's not... Well, it's not. It is poisonous, but it's not poisonous. So it's actually getting the poison from somewhere else and protecting itself by utilizing the poison from elsewhere in nature, which I think is kind of cool. Apparently, it does happen in some other species, but this is the first time that it's really been sort of confirmed, I guess, in your African crested rat. So
how toxic is this to humans? Because they're adorable and like, but could I pick one up without, you know, dying?
I think you could probably pick one up, but yeah, as I say, you wouldn't want to lick it. So you don't want to ingest this stuff. So these molecules are called cardenolides, and they are very similar to molecules that are found in foxglove, which is a thing called digitalis, which ironically is used in medicine in very, very, very small doses. Obviously, larger doses are not very good for you. But, you know, that's the way that it all works. So these very potentially toxic molecules and, you know, it's kind of, you know, a primitive tool, I guess. You know,
I imagine a lot of natural selection went into that. Yeah. Probably a lot of rats just dying from the poison before they.
Yes, you would imagine so. Yes.
What's their current conservation status?
Oh, that's a good question. I think they're sort of kind of few and far between. I believe anyway from sort of reading around them. But the one thing they haven't managed to be able to do apparently is to lick their back. And so that does make them vulnerable to aerial.
What, the rats or the scientists? Right.
I was confused by what you meant there. So you're saying that they're covered in poison except for their back.
Except for their back. Weak so point. You've got your good old eagles or whatever, or you know, whatever you've got in Africa coming along. And so really we're talking another few thousands years of evolution
before they develop a crane neck.
Yeah. So, yeah, a nice little sort of biological story for the day.
Yeah, I love animal stories. Yeah. All right, well, this next one, last but certainly not least, a diamond has been synthesized at room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Is this finally going to prove that diamonds are worthless?
Well, obviously, if they can do this on the large scale, then the price will plummet, one imagines. But ordinarily, well, okay, so diamonds are made of carbon, we all know that, and so also is graphite. That is also made of carbon, so the stuff in your pencil lead. And you couldn't imagine two more different things. Graphite's nice and soft, and it's black and, you know, not particularly appealing looking. Diamonds are the complete opposite. They're very, very hard. They're very, very beautiful. Hence the fact that everybody wants diamonds. Now, two problems with that. First is you can only get diamonds formed at very, very, very high pressures and very, very, very high temperatures. And number two, whoopsie, I'm hitting the mic today, folks, sorry. And number two, what was number two? Number two, diamonds are in fact actually unstable at room temperature and pressure, which will come as news to those of you who are listening with a diamond on your finger. Luckily, the process of conversion of diamond to graphite is very, very slow. So
it takes billions of years.
It does indeed, yes. Yeah. Yeah. But I always tell my first year students that and they'll go, wow. So obviously, people would like a way to make diamond without having to resort to very high pressures, very high temperatures. Well, some Aussies have gone halfway with that, and they have found a way of making diamonds. Now, when I say diamonds, I mean nano diamonds. So we're talking real tiddlers here. Scale. Very, very small scale. Without having to work under very, very high temperatures. So they do have to go under very, very high pressures, and this is around about 800,000 times atmospheric pressure. And the only way that you can get that sort of pressure is by using something very hard, and ironically, it's a diamond anvil that they have to use, because remember, diamond is one of the hardest substances known. And so they pump that up to this enormous pressure. Now, the interesting thing, okay, so they're using a thing called glassy carbon, which is another form of carbon. It looks a little bit like graphite, except there's no sort of order there. And they take this to very, very, very high pressures. But the important thing is, instead of just applying the pressure from above, they also allow some shear. So, you know, pressure at an angle. And what you've got to do is basically take the atomic positions in this glassy carbon and convert them to the atomic positions in diamond. If you can do that, you're laughing. So you're basically talking about moving atoms to the right place, and that obviously takes enormous pressures to be able to do that. But it's this shear, the fact that you can slide essentially the atoms sort of into the right place, that allow you now seemingly to be able to do this at, yes, these very high pressures, but you don't need the temperatures now, so you can do this at room temperature now. And of course, so-called natural diamonds in planet Earth, they've been sitting in the Earth under those enormous pressures for years and those enormous temperatures, etc., etc. And, you know, that's a very, very, very slow process, the crystallization of diamonds. So, you know, these guys might be able to do it. You can already make artificial diamonds, but, you know, it's not they're not going to be replacing the natural ones anytime soon, I guess.
As with a lot of dear science stories, this is a wait and see.
With pretty much every damn science. You know, science evolves. That's the beauty of it, yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Alan. We'll be back right after this.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.